Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Discover the story of the culture warrior, Don Wildman, and how he went head-to-head with Hollywood, Playboy, the homosexual agenda, and the Disney empire. The movement Don started paved the way for Christians to boldly stand for truth and righteousness in a hostile culture. Watch Culture Warrior today for free. Visit culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It's Monday, April 7th, and tariffs are the talk of the town. And whether or not Trump's economic plan is going to be a good long-term plan for America, America first, for our manufacturing, for our economy, all of those things. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Europe yesterday says the U.S. has to, quote, reset the global order of trade, and Trump is absolutely right to do it. He says the markets will adjust following President Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariffs last week. And so there's been a lot of chatter on social media, particularly on X, of course, because that's the main political platform, but then all kinds of other platforms trying to explain exactly what's going on. I think there's been a lot of different takes, but also a little bit misunderstanding and hopefully some understanding of exactly what tariffs are. But more broadly than that, what Trump's economic plan actually contains. And so there is an Instagram post from a guy named Mohammed Adnay, who some of you who follow economics more closely than I do may be familiar with him, but he had a really good kind of breakdown of three different points of Trump's economic plan. So listen to this.
Whatever you think of Trump, his economic plan makes complete sense. The U.S. has $36 trillion in debt. In 2025, they will spend $6 trillion, but will only collect $4 trillion in revenue. So they need to borrow $2 trillion, and this will increase their debt to $38 trillion. Trump's economic plan is based on three levers. Number one, cut expenses by $1 trillion, which is Doge, Elon Musk. He's targeting waste and fraud, like Social Security payments for people who are 150 years old. That is just fraud. Two, increasing revenue by $1 to $2 trillion through number one, tariffs. They will increase tariffs from $50 billion to $500 billion target. People will say, but other countries will retaliate. They will not be able to do it. The U.S. is the biggest customer on Earth. They consume $20 trillion every year. They are the biggest importer. They import $3 trillion every year. Plus, the current tariffs is actually not fair. Why should U.S. cars entering Europe faces 10% tariffs while the European cars entering the U.S. just pay 2.5%? It's not fair. And because of the tariff changes, it now makes economic sense to build factories and businesses inside the U.S. again. That means more jobs, means tax-paying businesses, and more foreign investment coming in. He will also increase revenue by deregulation. He will remove unnecessary regulations and rules, making it easier to do business, so business can grow faster, generate more tax revenues. He also makes this gold card, which is offering lifetime U.S. residency for 5 million. I think at least 1 or 2 million individuals globally can afford it. So if just 10% of them, if just 100,000 people buy this card, that's $1 trillion in incremental revenue. The third lever is he will reduce taxes. If he successfully cut $1 trillion in waste and expenses and add $1 to $2 trillion in revenue, the U.S. will have a surplus. They will have more money than they want. So he will cut taxes. For individuals, anyone gaining more than $150,000, he will make them pay zero taxes. And on corporate taxes, he will go down from the current 21% to 15%, compared to the European average of 22%. France average is 25, I think, and Germany is 30. So at 15% corporate tax, the US will become one of the most business attractive countries on earth. Bottom line, this is exactly how a government should be run, efficiently. Because when you eliminate waste, the money can actually go where it is actually needed, to the elderly, to the sick, to people who cannot work. And that is the real purpose of government, to protect the weak. Very few countries have the political will to do it. It takes leaders with backbone, charisma, and clarity of vision. Do you have leaders in your country pushing for real reform, or are they talking about non-relevant side topics? And let me know if you think Trump's plan is bad. Let me know why, because I think it is just common sense.
Just common sense, perhaps. It sounds like trying to balance our budget to me. But let's welcome in Kevin Freeman, who is the host of the Economic War Room and Pirate Money right here on American Family Radio Network. It's a podcast that is an AFR exclusive, so you can click on the podcast tab and click on and listen to Pirate Money. So, Kevin, good morning. And I know you were listening to that explanation, which I thought was a helpful breakdown, at least as I'm trying to kind of sift through what exactly is going on with Trump's economic plan overall. So how do you describe what's going on right now? Good idea or maybe a little bit concerning?
Well, Jenna, good morning. And you can also hear Pirate Money Radio on Saturdays on AFR. We air live on Saturday morning. But what I heard was absolutely factual, correct, true, but it's missing one key element, and that is a lot of what we're facing today is globalist pushback against the Trump administration. They cannot afford to let Trump succeed. And so there is a concerted globalist effort, whether it is hiring people to go and damage Teslas and throw rocks through windows, scratch, burn, whatever, to make Elon Musk back off on Doge, or whether it is attacking Le Pen in France or anyone else who dares to stand against the globalist regime, there is this globalist pushback. And so you'll see the media and you'll see governments around the world attempting to do anything they can to discredit what is logical, rational, reasonable approach by the Trump administration to lower the deficit, to get fair trade, not just free trade on our part, but making sure both parties are acting in a fair fashion. And to reduce inflation and the deficit. So there's all of the things he said, but there's also this globalist pushback.
Yeah, and that's an important piece, of course, because with the tariffs that are on other countries, the market is fluctuating so much because there is uncertainty with how global leaders will potentially react. And so for people who are still maybe a little bit confused about exactly what tariffs are and what the plan is, I mean, reciprocal tariffs sound good. If these other countries are putting tariffs on our goods, why aren't we, in fairness, at least asking them to reduce theirs or at least having a similar amount? And so give us kind of a breakdown or a layman's view of what the United States is doing and what President Trump's plan is, because he's been talking about this for a really long time and I know is very invested in this plan. And if it goes well, it'll be great political capital for him. If it doesn't go well, this is everything that the Democrats are going to run on in 2026 and probably 2028 as well.
Yeah, so what we have with tariffs, essentially the United States has been the engine of the growth around the world. The second engine is China, but China has done it essentially through manipulating foreign trade practices, through intellectual property theft, through unfair taxation and trading advantages. The Chinese have been a leech on the markets, and the United States has been a willing blood donor. So to speak. Trump has seen, though, that we've just been taken for granted. Europe, as a result, has been able to install a lot of socialist policies, a lot of lifetime work policies and so forth, 4-day work weeks almost, 3-day work weeks in some cases, because the United States, we carried most of the military budget. We carried most of the financial budget. What President Trump has done is said, look, let's just be fair. Europe is fully capable. You can provide for your own defense. Europe is fully capable. You can literally produce more and demand more productivity from your workers and go from less socialism or from more socialism to less socialism. As a result, your economy will improve and the Americans will be leached less. And I think that's his view. And he's had that view for 30 years, if you watch television interviews, he says that other countries are taking advantage of the United States. Well, there's been this long-term globalist trend. You've got to have a weaker United States so that we can have a globalist governance. And that's what they pushed in the European Union, and they wanted to expand and broaden that. And then there was this pushback with Brexit and this pushback when we elected President Trump. We don't want to go that direction. It's echoes of 100 years ago. 100 years ago, we had a Spanish flu, very similar to the COVID pandemic. 100 years ago, we had Woodrow Wilson, who was elected as president, and then he literally lost his capabilities to operate and run the country. We had President Biden more recently. 100 years ago, they had the tariffs, and they attempted to push them into the Great Depression, which they successfully did, and set up for a great reset, FDR style. And that's what the intention is now. This is a globalist effort to take advantage of the situation and push the United States into globalism. President Trump has said no. He's pushing back, and they're pushing back on him. Obviously, 50 countries, according to Kevin Hassett yesterday, have seen our reciprocal tariff policy and said, hey, you know what? Let's go to zero tariffs with the United States. Let's make this fair. 50 countries have reached out. That's not the headline. The headline is the stock market's down here or there, and the stock markets can easily be manipulated in the short term through panic selling, through large institutions and so forth. But I think that President Trump has a good shot, and he needs to take the shot now because our debt is $37 trillion almost. And if we continue on this path, we will bankrupt at some point. So this is our shot. We need to take it now. I agree with what President Trump is doing. I hope that we can get out of this raising tariff strategy quickly with those 50 countries that say, hey, let's go to zero. Let's do that. Let's have real free trade, but it's got to be fair.
I'm speaking with Kevin Freeman, who's the host of the Economic War Room and also Pirate Money right here on American Family Radio Network. And Kevin, so as you mentioned, this has been a goal of Trump's and his economic vision for a long time, well before he ran for office. And so how is this plan different or maybe just a continuation of what he did economically in the first term?
I would say that this plan is better informed than what he did in the first term, in that he understands how Washington works. He understands where the pushback is coming. Now, we see all of these district court judges ruling against him, which is, you know, that's not my area. Jenna, that's your area. But it's just insanity to see these individual district courts ruling against him. But he is better prepared, better understanding of what needs to be done in order to accomplish his vision. Where we were before, he was interrupted by a combination of COVID and a bunch of people he thought that he put in place that aligned with his vision that really didn't seem all that willing to implement it. Now he's got people that are more willing to implement the vision. There is no COVID operating here, and he knows how Washington works better. So I think it will be a continuation of what he attempted to do, but better informed in its process.
And I hope you're right. And Trump has urged Americans to hang tough amid tariffs taking effect. And so this is coming from Town Hall that President Donald Trump is again showing the strength and resolve needed to put America first as his 10% universal tariffs take effect. Trump has called on Americans to hang tough and weather the short-term challenges, promising that the long-term benefits will be worth it. And so, Kevin, as people are looking at the market, they're looking at potentially a lot of price raises from things, auto sales all the way to coffee pods, which I personally, as listeners know, am very concerned about with my coffee. But you know, seriously, there are a lot of things that may in the short term have a real dramatic effect on people's ability to afford things that they actually need. And, you know, groceries and some of those things, not just necessarily larger purchases or luxuries. And also their portfolios are taking a hit. And so what's the long-term projection? I mean, how long are Americans going to hang tough before they want to see results?
Well, we're going to see certainly pain. But keep in mind, when you're paying because of a higher tariff, you're paying a little more for your goods and services that you're getting. The money is going somewhere. It's going to the United States government. As opposed to when you're paying through inflation, the money was going nowhere. The government was just printing excess money, and that was causing this inflation. It wasn't going anywhere. We have a $37 trillion debt. There will be paying to deal with it. And that's part of this. How long will America hang in there? Well, it's as long as President Trump is able to keep MAGA going. And that's the key. If the people completely turn on him, they'll be turning down a dark road that will lead, I fear, to bankruptcy for the United States at some point, and maybe a great reset that we've long warned about, where globalists take control and take power and so forth, central bank digital currencies and all of that. So if you believe in liberty, if you believe in freedom, you will want to hang in with this process. It's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be necessarily short, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You go the other path, there's only darkness.
And so how should Christians in particular view this opportunity, maybe as we are concerned, rightly so, wanting to perhaps trust the plan ultimately, but then, you know, look to God and the principles of Scripture to say, okay, we need to be wise as we navigate particularly the next couple of months or even years with economic uncertainty.
Well, if we're able to see a reduction, first off, we should pray always that God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Secondly, we should be praying for the people around the world who have been suffering under the evils of globalism and literally Marxist regimes that have popped up in places. But third, we should always have hope. There are other elements of the plan that are positive, of reducing taxes or keeping taxes low, reducing the size of government, reducing the size of regulation. We could see an entrepreneur boom in the United States. Every small increase, half 10% increase in regulation equals a half a percentage of increased economic activity. So if we reduced our regulations by 50%, we would see a boom in the American economy, and we'd be able to weather this storm very quickly and come out the other side in really good shape. So we should pray for wisdom. We should pray for understanding of our government leaders, which is always called for in scriptures. And we should pray for liberty. Christ brought us liberty. And so economic liberty would be a very, very good thing. And I believe that's part of the Trump plan. So I think that it's a very godly thing to pray for President Trump, and it's a very godly thing to pray that we get economic fairness and economic justice around the world. And I think this proposal and this plan heads that direction.
Really well said, Kevin Freeman. We need to consistently pray for our government and recognize that biblical principles are always attached. This isn't something that just because economics is not a specifically overtly Christian issue like we would recognize pro-life, for example, or, you know, the LGBTQ movement opposing that or standing up for traditional marriage, you know, those types of things. There still are principles that are biblical that undergird all policy that our government enacts, and they can either pursue justice and good or they can not. And then the people are oppressed, and even when the government pursues evil. So we need to always be mindful of what's going on, but also looking at it from a biblical worldview. So Kevin, really appreciate it. You can follow Kevin on X at Kevin D. Freeman X. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network Clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, the leftists continue to whine across the country, with Democrats staging protests in deep blue cities across the country. This is coming from Daily Wire. Opponents of President Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk gathered to rally across the U.S. on Saturday to protest the administration's actions. More than 1,200 hands-off demonstrations were planned by more than 150 groups, including civil rights organizations, labor unions, LGBTQ advocates, of course, right? Veterans and election activists. Town Hall said this: it's another massive coping exercise for people who don't understand why they lost the 2024 election. No doubt the media coverage is going to magnify and make these wine fests something more than they actually are. The reality is that all these protests were in deep blue enclaves, and they weren't well attended. It's not like during the first Trump presidency. Liberal America has been thoroughly gutted by 2024. They'll never admit it, but actions do speak louder than words. Even here, there's not much except for recycled chants and slogans that don't work anymore. So this coming as Europe is now trying to fine X, and there is a major potential for penalties in the European Union, of course, as all of the protests against Tesla and the stock is dropping. And so what about the major penalties from the European Union testing the boundaries of online speech, and also, according to the New York Times, could inflame tensions between the U.S. and Europe? Well, on that front, let's welcome in Christian Lasfall, who is the communications director for the Heritage Foundation, runs their social media. And Christian, this is, to me, just appears on face, unless there's some other substance that we'll get into that I'm not yet aware of just, again, trying to target X and Elon Musk for having a platform that allows free thought and conservative speech.
Yeah, Jenna, good morning. That's essentially what it is. This the fine that they're trying to levy on X actually is from the Digital Services Act. It's an act that was passed by the European Union back in 2022, but it went into full effect across all of the European Union in February 2024. And totally coincidentally, not at all targeted, X was the first platform that the Digital Services Act went after. It basically has requirements for what they term, what they classify as very large online platforms and very large online search engines. And that's determined by the number of users that they have, and obviously X qualifies for that. But the fine is essentially because they are not doing enough to curb what the European Union determines is hate speech or disinformation. So surprise, surprise, it's not really a coincidence. It is absolutely a targeted measure by the European Union to try and silence the opinions of those whom the establishment liberals disagree with.
So is this just targeting, is the EU right now at least just targeting X, or have they looked at Meta and some of these other platforms, or is this just clearly against Elon Musk?
So they have targeted other platforms as well, which the other ones obviously are much more compliant. They're doing their best to try and meet the speech restriction standards that the EU is requesting. However, it's important to note that the fine that they're trying to levy on X appears to be unique. So this was reported in the New York Times, and they reported that the European Union, the enforcement arm of the DSA, is looking to levy a fine of about $1 billion against X, which just seems like an absurd number. And it's interesting because the law in itself is vague to begin with. It doesn't really specify what counts as hate speech or disinformation. The terms they use to classify that could be easily interpreted one way or another, depending on the political whims of whoever's in charge, which in the case of the European Union is a bunch of left-wing elites. But the language of the Digital Services Act says that the fine can be up to 6% of the application's total annual turnover, which for X's case would be about, if they generate between $2 and $3 billion annually, those are the estimates of X's revenue, a 6% fine on that would only be about $174 million. So how are they getting this fine up to $1 billion? Well, despite the fact that the DSA, like I said, is already vague to begin with and easy to weaponize, the New York Times is reporting that the way they're trying to get to that $1 billion fine is actually by assessing the value of all of Musk's private ventures. So instead of just fining X as an individual platform, since Elon Musk is technically a private owner, they're trying to levy the fine based on Elon Musk as the chief owner of all of these corporations, the total of revenue that he brings in from all of his companies. So there's a provision that allows the DSA to do this, but it's supposed to be used, at least by plain reading, for something like, let's say, Meta, for example. If they were levying a fine against Facebook, instead of doing it just against Facebook, the platform, they're going to do it to Meta as the parent company. In X's case, SpaceX or XAI or all of Elon's other ventures, they're unrelated to X. And yet, if the New York Times' reporting is accurate, which the European Union Commission has come out and said, we're not even in talks about a fine yet, we'll see how true that is. If the New York Times' reporting is accurate, they're trying to weaponize a provision in a piece of legislation that is already primed for weaponization. So just as my colleague Daniel Cochrane puts it, a race to the bottom for free speech in Europe, which obviously has impact for the platform in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this type of regulation, then, if it impacts X in some of those ways in censorship, this wouldn't be limited to just the users in X on X that are in Europe. This would be anything that might appear in the feed in Europe, which is ostensibly, I mean, anything, even something that I post, you know, somebody could read in Europe, for example. And so what is Elon Musk's response to this so far?
They're trying to take it through every level of the court that they can in Europe. So far, it hasn't been all that successful. And unfortunately, with the way the court systems work over there, we don't know what the outcome will ultimately be. However, knowing Elon, he's not likely to give in easily. That's a very, very heavy fine to have to pay. I don't know if there's some way that the United States can help protect the platform from having to abide by the speech laws of a foreign country. But Elon is not likely to give in. You know, it's ironic because back in February, a certain Vice President J.D. Vance commented at the Munich Security Conference that the greatest threat to Europe is from within. And of course, the liberal elite of the European Union and Europe abroad, or Europe in general, mocked him and scoffed at him for suggesting such a thing. Yet here they are throttling the free speech of their citizens. And it's not just the European Union. It's even country specific as well. In Germany, a couple of weeks ago, 60 Minutes ran a giddy segment with some prosecutors from Germany bragging about how they can fine you or confiscate your electronics and, for repeat offenders, incarcerate you for what they determine to be hate speech or misinformation. And the host of that segment, Sharon Alfonsi, if I'm pronouncing her name right, talked about how the U.S. allows hate-filled and toxic speech, but Germany is, quote, trying to bring some civility to the World Wide Web. So it's a problem in the European Union that's being cheerleaded, which we saw at its full potential, at least in my lifetime here in 2020 during COVID, by Americans.
And I'm speaking with Christian Losfall, who is the social media manager for the Heritage Foundation. And you can follow him on X at Christian Losfall. And I'd encourage you to do that because he has a lot of really good takes and clips there. And so when we're talking about potentially the United States involvement in this and recognizing that it'll have some consequences potentially for X as a platform, and that doesn't sound like anything that Donald Trump would like either, we haven't heard a lot from the administration about the Digital Bill of Rights and, you know, some of these other things, as much as we've been talking Doge, economics, and obviously the activist judges. So there's a lot of things, though, that the news cycle is containing, and especially just in this 1 hour program, but even with the 24/7 news cycle, there's a ton of stuff to cover. Where is the Trump administration at with some of these rights and protections for individuals, not just the platforms, to be free from this type of ridiculous interference and so forth from places like the European Union, but individuals who have a right to hear from other people as well and opinions, whether or not some government entity or agency deems it misinformation or disinformation?
Yeah, as of right now, Jen, I don't have any inside information to know whether the Trump administration is working on the Digital Bill of Rights specifically. I know a lot of their focus right now is on trying to straighten out things in our economy. We do know that President Trump, in his first few days in office, including on day one, signed a number of executive orders to basically order the executive branch to stop trying to police people's speech. We know under the Biden administration, pretty much every agency they could possibly get their hands on, as we learned from the Twitter files, was trying to put pressure on social media companies and different organizations and platforms to get content that the ruling elites of the United States didn't want to be shared online. Opinions about COVID in particular, or treatments to it, or opinions about the upcoming election back in 2020 that they didn't want the American people to be able to share and discuss online. We know that President Trump has taken efforts right from the beginning of his second term to stop executive agencies from continuing on with that. But as of what are the next steps and what does that look like, I don't yet know. But I do know that President Trump has kept a lot of his promises. He's not one to forget if he made a commitment to the American people. And I have no doubt that the administration will make that a priority of theirs once they're through with trying to get this reconciliation bill through and try and straighten out the economy, which was one, and immigration, which were some of the top two issues that the American people said were on their mind when they cast their votes in November.
Yeah. And we know that there are some really good people working for him, including one of your former colleagues and one of my favorite guests that we lost, unfortunately, to the administration, which is very sad. Hopefully we'll get him back. But Jake Denton, who regular listeners will be familiar with, who used to be at Heritage in digital policy, is now in the administration. And we're really excited to have, you know, people like him that were recognized to go and serve in those areas. So that's a good thing. What about Congress as well? Is there anything on the digital rights side that you're aware of that Heritage is tracking that we should be aware of?
Right now in Congress, the name of the game is to try and get them to actually get some of these executive orders codified into law, which they have done next to nothing of. Unfortunately, Congress has been slow. They've been dragging their feet on the process on just about everything. And like I said, the first thing that they're going to try and get through is this reconciliation bill, which will hopefully have a lot of spending cuts and regulation cuts, making the DOGE cuts permanent. And that's kind of the first hurdle that we need to cross with Congress. And we haven't even gotten past that yet. But after that point, we need to start taking a look at the language and some of the executive orders that President Trump signed when he first came into office and try and make those protections permanent so that platforms in the United States or individual state legislatures in the United States can't take a page out of the European Union's book and try and enforce similar speech codes on Americans here in the United States. Because you have to imagine, the European Union is kind of like the trial balloon for Democrats in the United States who admire the way that they're able to police their speech and would like to replicate those efforts here. So you have to imagine that they're taking notes from this and wanting to implement similar things here. Once we get over the hurdle of the reconciliation bill coming up and trying to make sure that we get our fiscal house in order so that we have a country that we can continue on in and afford our cost of living and everyday life, then we can talk about making sure that we make some of these free speech protections permanent so that it doesn't rely on the signature of the current sitting president, but exists in law for the entire country that can't be as easily repealed.
Yeah, so well said, and I agree with that. And it's been really frustrating to see that the attention has been shifted with Representative Anna Paulina Luna siding with Democrats and calling for this ridiculous proxy voting issue, and how that has kind of taken away attention from getting some of this done so that Congress can actually use its majority and trifecta to codify some of these executive orders. So it's been frustrating to see that, you know, Congress is being Congress and Republicans aren't really getting it together. But hopefully we will see a little bit more action and movement there. But Christian Losfall, always really appreciate your time and your expertise. So again, follow him on X at Christian Losfall, and you can follow Heritage Foundation at Heritage. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's continue to talk about reducing government influence in people's lives and how states are also trying to adhere to perhaps some of the biblical principles of suggesting that government needs to stay confined to its legitimate, limited role. And here in Florida, there's something called Hope Florida, which was an initiative by First Lady Casey DeSantis and Brian Griffin, who is the governor's comms director and press secretary, posted this last week. The Florida legacy media is desperate to smear Hope Florida because it's a completely new philosophy of reducing government influence in people's lives. Just look at how the national media is attacking DOGE to see how vehemently they resist any attempt to shrink government. These reporters are now bragging about showing up to the Department of Children and Families and trying to bully the staff into letting them into the office to continue their witch hunt. All of the outlets and articles on Hope Florida are hit jobs. None of them highlighted the good it does or the people it helps. So it goes on to say, your media are activists who work together to push their bias on you every single day. So let's talk about what Hope Florida actually is and why this is, in my opinion as well, a great model for other states. So let's welcome in Pastor Dean Insera, who is the pastor of City Church in Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning, Pastor Dean, and tell us about Hope Florida.
Yeah, good morning. It's great to be with you. I mean, I agree with Brian 100%. Hope Florida is an opportunity to get people less dependent on the government. Shouldn't that be everyone's goal that works in anything from the political sphere to those that are just voting citizens across the state of Florida? And it allows people to be connected to needs in our state. So rather than having to simply go through a program or through a handout, it allows individuals in the state of Florida, organizations, churches, faith-based groups, to get connected to people in their community who have needs, not just random needs in a vague sense, but specific needs, where you will get notice through the systems that are in place that someone needs a bed for their child, that someone needs a meal for this coming weekend, that someone needs a coat because they can't afford to have a jacket that's getting colder this weekend. And it allows specific needs to be met through actual people on the ground that then can show up at their home with no cameras on, develop a relationship, and really help for a long term, where they can actually get paired with that family, that individual, that single mom, whoever it may be, and have a relationship for a long time that is not just needs-based, but then actually develops what can I do for you personally? And it's just a really neat thing that allows citizens to be mobilized for the effort rather than the state doing all the work.
Yeah, and this makes so much sense that Hope Florida is bringing together the private sector, faith-based community, I mean, like churches who actually should be doing this work, and nonprofits that basically utilize the support of Hope Florida to just connect to the people who are in need, and that the numbers are really staggering about just through this one effort, so many Floridians have actually gotten off of government assistance and on to providing for themselves and their own lives, which ultimately saves taxpayers a lot of money in the long term, but is beneficial for the individual, unlike the leftist response that wants more people dependent on government handouts so that government can control them. This is all about enhancing liberty and freedom and encouraging the church to engage. So why is this even controversial in Florida? This seems like such a great opportunity for the church to step in and partner with the civil government to ultimately do its job to help the widow, the orphan, and those in need.
Yeah, I mean, from a church perspective, a healthy church has the members doing ministry, right? Where the staff is maybe navigating and the staff is helping resource and create opportunities. But a healthy church is one where the actual people of the church are doing the work of the church. That's a very biblical principle, a very healthy church. And I think the same thing, it's being played out in real life, where we don't want to see just simply the government doing the work. We want to see the people of the state of Florida, serving one another and meeting needs. And what a great place to do that. And the best place to do that is faith-based organizations who already exist for those purposes. And I'm in a government town. I'm in Tallahassee, so I don't want to be naive. I mean, I know everything happens to be political in a government town. It all goes back to that. But I think part of it's the climate we're in right now, where everyone has to take sides. And this is just one of those things that should transcend that. You mentioned Brian's post about DOGE, and I'm just fascinated by the fact that cutting government waste and trying to be more responsible is controversial. I'm not saying DOGE is perfect. Nothing is this side of heaven, right, in a fallen world. But that's just fascinating to me that is controversial. People are going bananas over DOGE. And the same thing is going to happen here. A lot of it's just politicized, where people are trying to draw lines and trying to play power and egos and the things that get in the way. And when it comes to something like Hope Florida, all that should be put aside and say, and there's absolutely room for debate on what's the best way to help our neighbors. There's always room for debate on that. But when you have a clear-cut example of something that's working, I've seen it up close as a pastor, that actually real life is making an impact in our state and is mobilizing neighbors to actually do the work of serving one another and providing for needs that can benefit someone and get them on their feet for a long time. It's just sad to me that it's the partisanship is getting in the way, and not just partisanship, but also power plays and just trying to, I don't know if it's, trying to thumb it to the administration or whatever it could be, but my hope for all Floridians would be we would just continue to get behind this and say this is a wonderful thing for our state and for our neighbors and to go full speed ahead with it.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Pastor Dean Insera, who's the pastor of City Church in Tallahassee. And I love that you underscored that it should be the membership of the church, not just people coming Sunday morning and then they leave and go about their business. My church, Family Church in Florida, I love it so much because one of our consistent themes is to go and be the church. And so members come to benefit from the teaching of the Word of God on Sundays, but then we are called scripturally and expected through our membership to go and be the church. And this is a way that Hope Florida is a way that the state is actually encouraging the church to do what we're biblically commanded to anyway, instead of opposing the church. I mean, that's the whole, to me, one of the best benefits of this program is that it's something that's actually wanting the church and helping facilitate the church doing its mission and fulfilling its calling and giving members the opportunity to be the church. And rather than what we saw and what we see oftentimes from the left of this whole notion that's false of separation of church and state, basically saying, church, you confine to your little Sunday mornings and don't try to affect policy, don't try to come into the state, don't bring any of your values. This is something where the state is saying we want to partner with churches because we recognize the importance of their mission. And we as the church and Christians should absolutely be taking advantage of that partnership and opportunity.
Yeah, it's a wide open door. And I'm not trying to suggest that the church is the government and the government is the church. I know you don't believe that. I don't believe that. But people are people. And I think there is a common good mandate that we have to contribute to human flourishing. We believe that all people are made in the image of God. And there's an opportunity for us to continue. This is not a new thing. It's already happening. It's already on the ground. There's already differences being made in communities across our state. And my hope is that those who are making decisions down downtown Tallahassee just want to keep that going full speed ahead and actually take that to a whole new level and say, let's get behind this. Let's just really, and it is a new initiative, but let's give it a shot. Like, it's already working. Let's give it a jolt and go full speed for the common good of human flourishing across the state of Florida. There's so many good things happening in our state right now, and this is another way to, I think, just take it to a whole new level.
Yeah, absolutely. And the numbers already show a lot of that success for Hope Florida. And, and you mentioned Pastor Dean, and I fully agree with you that, the state isn't the church. The church isn't the state. I mean, those are two different jurisdictions under the authority of God. And we see that in scripture with the three institutions that God ordained as the church government, the civil government, and the family government. And yet we see consistently from the left kind of this myth that just because they're separate jurisdictions, they need to be entirely separate and Christians can't and shouldn't engage with government. And, for those who maybe are a little bit new to this program, or, if you're a Democrat or hater, welcome. We're happy you're here. This may be the only opportunity that you've ever had to hear truth.
Progressive church, they think it was the greatest thing ever. If it was a progressive church, they would be celebrating it. A progressive administration, they'd be thinking it's the greatest thing that's ever existed.
Yeah, and that's such a great point, is that then they would be saying, oh, look, we're trying to get you out for government welfare and all this other stuff. But because it's a conservative Republican administration with Governor DeSantis and the First Lady's initiative, then, oh, suddenly we're going to bring up this false flag of, separation of church and state, or we're going to, say all these other kinds of political nonsense. But just from a broader philosophical perspective, let's talk about that myth of the separation of church and state, because when we see the commandment in scripture for the church, that necessarily requires that the church is engaged in our civil government and our community. And politics, often as one of my pastors describes it, politics is truth in community, a good view of policy and politics, truth in community. And the church necessarily has to engage that.
Definitely. I think that is a great way to put it. And Jesus talks about being salt and light. It's easy to talk about the salt or the light part. People love to say light and darkness, and that's a very Christian, obviously, principle. It's from the mouth of Christ. But we oftentimes underestimate the significance of what he meant by salt. And salt is a preserver, right? Salt brings flavor. Salt takes away from decay and from rot and gets into the brokenness. So as Christians, we want to be people who champion that. And for those maybe who aren't believers, I would still hope that they want to see the flourishing of their neighbors and to see differences made. And so politics for too long has been viewed by the church as something we can't touch, something that's out of bounds, when really it's something that we should embrace and engage in a way that allows us to enter into the public sphere, enter into the community as salt and light and make a difference, because we're not dependent upon the government, but we can see the government as something that can facilitate and help drive real good being done if it's done the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. Pastor Dean and Sarah, my special guests this morning. The government can either be used as a tool to help protect the rights and liberties of churches and families to engage in the way that God has commanded and requires, or it can thwart that. And we see in Scripture, it says, when we have good leaders and the people rejoice, when we have evil leaders, that the people groan, paraphrasing Psalms there. And that has been very true, that we've seen that distinction on the federal level over the last several presidential cycles. And we've certainly seen the distinctions here in Florida, I mean, which is the key reason that I moved here. It's because of the opportunity of human flourishing, of liberty, of freedom. I mean, that's why we call it the Free State of Florida, and contrasting that to so many people in California, for example, who are moving because they're saying, you know, just the other day it was like, oh, they're implementing yet another tax on whatever. And it's like all of these people are saying, well, wait a minute. I want to have more of my own hard-earned wealth, and that's a biblical principle of private property. And so when all of these decisions are being made, it is a biblical principle to look at how the state is either interfering with the rights and liberties that come from God, our Creator, to the people, or they're facilitating the free exercise thereof. And so one of the things that I see Hope Florida doing is encouraging through this facilitation of engaging the church in true ministry, but is really encouraging more opportunity for families here who wouldn't otherwise have the benefit of getting off welfare, to understand some of these principles and to engage with getting themselves on the right track. And so just in the last few minutes we have with you here, tell us a couple, if you would, of just maybe some personal stories of your engagement with Hope Florida and how that has impacted people, so that, you know, we're not just talking about this philosophically, but people even in other states can see, oh, maybe as a member of my church, I need to do something similar.
Yeah, so one thing you get asked regularly as a church is the famous, what are you doing for the community? And that's a fair question, but that can just almost seem daunting, right? Because there's a large community out there, and there's so many things to be involved with. So if you're not doing someone's maybe one or two pet projects, but you're doing these other things, all of a sudden you're not doing enough. You're not doing enough for the community. So the pastor, or just anyone in church leadership, you hear about that a lot. You get that question. Well, I want to be able to answer that question, and I can give you a list of the I'm putting air quotes up, the things we do for the community, but I'd rather do like one or two things really well than do like 15 or 20 things okay. That's just my leadership style. So this allows us to say, what are we doing locally for Tallahassee and the surrounding area? We're involved in Hope Florida. Like, that's what we're doing. Like, that's the lane that we're going to run into. And so that allows us to have a very clear cut, this is what we're doing, rather than being spread thin. And churches like ours are set up, they have, you know, small groups, some churches have Sunday school classes, Bible studies. So we have a specific place to go with the requests that are happening. So a small group in our church, we made aware of a opportunity through Hope Florida, through the channels that we have, through Care Portal, that will make us aware of a family, an individual, a single mother, whoever it could be, that is in our community. And again, there's no strings attached. We're not doing this because we want someone to come to our church. What we want to do is because we want to meet the needs of our neighbors. And that relationship then continues. So it's not just a one-time deal. Granted, a one-time deal is obviously better than a no-time deal, but it allows that need to continue. Like, okay, we've met you. We showed up to your house, our small group, our Sunday school class, our group of friends in the community. We went to your house and you invited us in and we had a chance to meet your children. And so now because of that, we want to continue and engage in this relationship. So it allows our church to have a clearly defined lane to make a difference.
Yeah, that is such a great opportunity. And so thank you so much, Pastor Dean and Sarah, for coming on this morning. And for anyone in Florida, you can go to hopeflorida.com and click on either Get Help or Give Help. And if you are a Christian, we should always be engaged in ministry. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.